Okay. Let me give a slightly more specific title to the talk, which is Scaling of Pressure Fluctuations in Isotropic Turbulence. It's somewhat more restricted. We don't have Arkady Tsinober here to tell us that scaling isn't everything, so we can just go ahead, but he'll be here next week. And let me start by giving a little advertisement. I've done something for the American Journal of Physics, which is a journal for physics teachers. And they do by invitation things they call resource letters, which are annotated bibliographies. And I just finished one on turbulence, which is available on the Los Alamos bulletin board, and which should have appeared already in the American Journal of Physics, but has not, so it should be out any month now. They warned me that they're late. Now, the other papers that I will refer to are listed here, and I may or may not get to number four, but I would like to. It depends how much time we have and how things go. Okay, now what is the idea? Well, I guess we should start by reminding you that we can assume that everyone knows the Navier-Stokes equation. And I remind you that if you take the divergence of the Navier-Stokes equations, you get an expression for the Laplacian of the pressure is equal to minus the divergence of the V dot grad V term. And that alone tells you quite a bit about the pressure in incompressible turbulence. First of all, it tells you that the pressure at a given point in time. Now, this can be I'm not going to write down the Poisson equation. This is a Poisson equation, which means that the pressure as a function of space and time can be gotten as an integral over the velocity field. It tells you that the pressure is not, as you would expect, since it's there to enforce incompressibility, is not an independent quantity. If you know everything about the velocity field, you know everything about the pressure. And then you might ask, why bother study it for itself? And you'll see that the reason that we're going to study it for itself is that simple scaling arguments which work for the velocity field in both experiment and direct numerical simulation don't work very well for the pressure, and we're going to try to understand why. So that's the theme of the talk. Why is the pressure seem not to scale in any simple way when the velocity field shows fairly simple scaling? I'm doing everything's in isotropic homogeneous turbulence for the moment, and boundary conditions could be quite serious. So this is all in a periodic box. So we know that the pressure then is the pressure is a nonlinearity of the same order as the quadratic nonlinearity due to the velocity field. It's spatially non-local, and because of the incompressibility constraint, the pressure at a given time is determined by the velocity field everywhere at the same time. So that's already quite a bit of useful information. We can massage this equation using the incompressibility condition, and we can write it in other forms. The one which is going to be most useful here is that it can be written in terms of velocity derivatives alone. And since the velocity derivatives are thought of as small-scale quantities, it suggests that pressure differences on small scales will be determined by velocity differences on small scales, and I won't have any argument with that. There's a second way we can write this, which is provocative, again using incompressibility, is that you can write the Laplacian of the pressure as a half the squared vorticity minus the square of the strain field. This is interesting, and this fourth paper has to do with that. But from a point of view that I'm taking here now, where we want to actually try to calculate the pressure and how the pressure is scaling, this is almost worse than useless. It's the cancellations between these two things are so strong that it is completely hopeless to use this to calculate the pressure. However, they are also so strong that you can derive some things which are kind of cute, but you can't calculate anything with that. Now, of course, we always start in the discussion of small scales and isotropic homogeneous turbulence. We always start with Kolmogorov, 1941, and we can support, as you'll see in a minute, we can support this in a somewhat more careful way. And we would suspect, if we wanted to look, for example, at the difference in pressure between two points separated by a distance r, we wanted to look, I'll concentrate almost entirely, just to keep things simple, on the so-called second order pressure structure function, the mean square pressure difference between two points. And if you wanted to estimate this, you would naively assume, and it's not really such a bad thing to assume, as we'll see later, that this goes approximately like the velocity difference between two points raised to the fourth power. So there's a pressure difference. The pressure should roughly scale as velocity squared, so the mean square pressure difference should scale as the fourth moment of the velocity difference. And that may have small corrections to Kolmogorov, but that would suggest that at least roughly the pressure means the pressure structure function should go approximately like the energy dissipation rate to the four-thirds power times the separation to the four-thirds power. Where did I get this from? Well, there are a lot of ways of getting it. I think I'm going to start from the Hill-Wilczek exact expression, but I just wanted to just sort of wave my hands now. Yeah, I'm obviously not going to derive that, but yeah. Now, this is just to give some kind of background, and I'm not going to do anything in Fourier space, but this suggests that the pressure structure function in the inertial, this is all for inertial range separations, should go roughly as the four-thirds power of the separation. The corresponding pressure spectrum should go as wave number to the minus seven-thirds power. And in direct numerical simulations, where the velocities do more or less what's expected of them, the pressure doesn't. It doesn't give any sort of decent power law. That should go, the pressure spectrum you'd expect in analogy to Kolmogorov arguments or dimensional arguments would go like at k to the minus seven-thirds. And it does not. Some people have tried to fit it to power laws of sorts, but we'll my feeling is it doesn't scale, but that's still controversial. I mean, you're stealing my punchline, but you'll see. Remember that there isn't a broad enough one for the velocity to scale either, but it does. So, yeah.
What is the best source of data?
Best source of numerical DNS data, or because it's sort of experimental data. We should. Bill George isn't here, but he did this experiment back in 1974, and there hasn't been. I haven't seen much experimental data which is relevant.
What about DNS?
DNS, it's built in. I mean. I think they're all pretty much equally good. Let me go a little further, and there's a very nice exact result, which is due to Reg Hill and Jim Wilczek in JFM in 1995. Oh, he will. Okay, I haven't seen him for a long time. I'm not giving things in historical order now because I'm jumping over 50 years, and then I'll come back because it's a useful exact result and it's worth starting from. For the case of isotropic homogeneous turbulence, they were able to derive an exact connection between the mean square pressure difference between two points and the fourth moments of the velocity difference. However, you have to recognize that there is not only one, but three independent fourth-order velocity, fourth-order velocity structure functions. Supposing I have two points in a fluid separated by a distance r, and the turbulence is homogeneous and isotropic, let u be the component of the velocity along that distance, the so-called longitudinal component, and let v be the one of the transverse components, then there are in fact three independent fourth order velocity structure functions. One of these is the so-called longitudinal structure function, which is just the fourth moment of the longitudinal velocity difference between two points, and the transverse structure function, which is the fourth moment of the transverse velocity difference between two points. And then there's a mixed one, which if you want to make engineering noises, you can relate to Reynolds stress fluctuations, and that is the product of the two. Now, isotropy does not restrict you beyond three independent quantities at this order. And although there are some papers in the literature by people who will remain unnamed who suggest that these things can be related, that nothing has, it ain't so. And what Hill and Wilczek did was to give an exact integral expression for the mean square pressure difference in terms of these three quantities. And let me write it down in somewhat schematic form. The mean square pressure difference between two points is, it can be written, I'll introduce a couple of simple integral operators, one of which I call I greater minus a third, operating on the longitudinal term, and then there's another term which is I lesser plus I greater, operating on the transverse term, and then there's a negative term. This term is in fact always positive, although that's not obvious. This term is always positive. And then there's a negative term, which is minus 6 times I greater plus 3 times I lesser, operating on the mixed term. And these operators are defined, the L greater operating on an arbitrary function of R is defined as I greater, operating on an arbitrary function A is 4/3 R squared times the integral from R to infinity y to the minus 3 a of y dy, and the I lesser is 4/3 times integral from 0 to r y to the minus 1 a of y dy. This is in Hill's paper, but the notation is slightly different, and he groups the terms different. This formula is the basic formula derived in Hill's paper.
But it's also contained in arguments of Batchelor.
No, I'll come back. I'll make the connection to Batchelor in a minute. No, it is not contained in Batchelor. It's just easier to do Batchelor as an approximate consequence of this than to introduce it first. So this is an exact relation. Now, there are many things you can see from this right away.
So where does it
start? You start from this thing and just put in isotropy constraints and crank, basically. In the original, what Batchelor did in back about 1950, and Yaglom did a little before that, was to start from this to get the pressure difference between two points starting from this Poisson equation in this form, integrate by parts a variety of times, but then rather early and use all the isotropy constraints you can. And Yaglom did in late 40s and Batchelor in 1951 was to, at the same time, do a quasi-Gaussian factorization of these fourth-order structure functions. And he did the quasi-Gaussian factorization first and then did the integration by parts. Hill and Wilczek realized at a later date when we were worried about intermittency and the fact that these things might not be quasi-Gaussian and so on, they realized that there was nothing in Batchelor's calculation that required you to do that. You could go through the whole thing and only make the quasi-Gaussian factorization afterwards, and so they just did it. So this is all, all of this is in the Monnier and Yaglom book, and it was, just the order of which you make certain approximations is different than it was done 50 years ago. Yeah, isotropy. Well, sure is. No, not at this stage. There's no quasi-normal. I'll come back to the quasi-normal in a minute, just to give you a reference point. But even before you do that, you can see that certain things are okay. For example, supposing that the velocity structure functions behave just roughly as Kolmogorov suggests, not exactly, but roughly, so that each of these terms, if r is an inertial range distance, each of these terms scales roughly as r to the fourth thirds. So these guys are finite in the inertial range and have a rough power law behavior with about that exponent. That's sufficient to tell you that the inertial range pressure is determined by inertial range velocities. So there are no deep problems with this. Well, the point is that the zero is you get cut off in a dissipation. If r is an inertial range distance, then this integral is dominated by inertial range values of y. And if r is much smaller than the integral length scale, then this integral is dominated by inertial range values of y also. So if the velocity has a decent inertial range, then so does the pressure. If the fourth order velocity structure functions have decent inertial ranges, then so does the pressure. They're both nicely convergent at those upper limits. So that the upper limit, the behavior of the limits doesn't affect the inertial range behavior of the pressure structure. So that's actually, so the qualitative idea that pressures scale like velocities squared is okay. The problem is there's more than one velocity involved. A homogeneous isotropic turbulence. Other than that, there are no approximations. Okay, now let's see what happens if you do the... Now let's go back 50 years and see if we can recover the 50-year-old results by making the quasi-Gaussian approximation on this expression. And I guess I... So supposing I do quasi-Gaussian, that means that the longitudinal one is written as 3 times the mean square separation. And the transverse one is written as 3 times the second moment of the transverse velocity. And the next one is just the product of the two. But we're making quasi-Gaussian, we've neglected any intermittency effects, and we've written the fourth order structure function in terms of... What's the difference between Gaussian and quasi-Gaussian? Oh, that's just a way of saying that you know that the third moment of delta U doesn't vanish. Okay, so it can't be strictly Gaussian because the third moment of delta U we know does not vanish. So. But now we've reduced it to second order, only the second order structure functions. And at fourth order, isotropy doesn't put any constraints on these things. But at second order, it does. At second order, the longitudinal and transverse velocity structure functions are not independent. There's an explicit relationship between them, which I can write down if you want. But if you now do this factorization, substitute the relationship between this guy is simply related to this guy due to isotropy. Substitute that all in to this expression and turn the crank. And I must admit, although I didn't go through every step of the Hill-Wilczek paper, I did at least do this because I knew what answer you're supposed to get then. And you get the result that was given by Batchelor in 1951. And let me write it down. It's very similar in structure to, I mean, it has all the same qualitative properties. And so this is that the mean square pressure difference is integral from 0 to r, y times, oh, I've got to be careful about, all right, I'll define this DLL in a minute. I'm now using Monin and Yaglom's notation. Plus the integral from y to infinity of r squared over y times the same, the derivative of the longitudinal structure function dy, where I just switched notation on you and this guy is just my delta u squared. Now again, r squared divided by y. Nothing. They're just simple algebra. No. The lower limit of it's of course r. Yes. And I of course didn't have to put the r squared inside the integral. Yeah. And now if you have the same properties that we had before, that if you take an inertial range value of r, both of these integrals are dominated by the velocity structure function in the inertial range. And this then will give you the, if the longitudinal structure function goes as r to the 4/3, the derivative goes as r to the 1/3, plug all these things in and you will get back the epsilon to the 4/3, r to the 4/3. And you'll even get the numerical coefficient, because if you know the Kolmogorov constant, which goes into here, then the thing which comes out. In fact, the final result is rather simple. If delta u is some constant times epsilon to the 2/3 r to the 2/3, and that constant, I forget now exactly what that is. Known, Sweeney has all these things in his head. Then the delta p is exactly c squared with no numerical coefficient in front times epsilon to the 4/3, r to the 4/3. So this result is, in fact, was given by Batchelor about 50 years ago and given by Yaglom, or maybe it was Obukhov or Monin, I can't remember, a few years before that. And because when I did a review article a few years ago, I referred this to Batchelor, and of course Yaglom wrote me a letter saying, no, you look in Monin Yaglom, you'll find we did it sooner. And then in one place in the book he said this was an unknown coefficient, but another place in the book he said it was known. So I looked in the wrong place, so I said he didn't give the numerical coefficient, but he pointed out to me that he did. So, as usual, it's all there and it's all right. But you begin to see what's going on from just this simple exercise. And you don't see it if you just start off and make the quasi-Gaussian approximation first. Because in the full Hill and Wilczek formula, this term is positive, this term is positive, and this term is negative. Now, you can go to the inertial range where everything is going as a power law and just plug in the quasi-Gaussian longitudinal, quasi-Gaussian transverse, quasi-Gaussian mixed, and ask how much cancellation is there. And the answer is that this term cancels 95% of these two. They all scale in the same way, but this term cancels 95% of the two positive terms. Now, that's not a, you know, that's not a, I've never seen exactly, so the pressure is small. Yeah? In the you evaluate all the integrals by plugging power laws in and again neglecting the effects of the limits, and you put in the known, you use the isotropy constraints, you use everything you know, so that within the quasi-Gaussian approximation there is a 95% cancellation between this term and these two, and he'll notice that back in the early 90s. The question is, what lesson do you want to draw from it?
Well, Mark, I'm sure that's totally right.
Oh, I'm sure it's right.
I'm sure in the paper I wrote with Brian Kondrupper in 1984,
mm-hmm.
we used the quasi-Gaussian to close the turbulence turbulence piece that we're talking about. And the spectrum of the pressure fluctuation came out to be exactly the same.
That's right, yeah. Well, you didn't have the. You know, I remember your expression, but I'm starting from the Hill-Wilczek formula, and I'm.
But your comment that quasi-Gaussian cannot produce that result.
I didn't say that.
I thought you said.
Oh no, this is quasi-Gaussian. What I said was that within the quasi-Gaussian, if you plug the quasi-Gaussian into the Hill-Wilczek formula,
okay. You
find that these terms are have an amplitude 20, and these have an amplitude 19, and they.
I didn't realize you were
yeah. Yeah, no, I am. Let's see. And that, I think, is the... So then the question is... And now you begin to see why the pressure might not scale. Because if you have small corrections... Okay, in the quasi-Gaussian, you don't have any corrections. But if you have small corrections to... If the power law for this is slightly different, which we think it is due to intermittency, than the quasi-Gaussian value. And if the quasi... If the power law for this is... if it exists, is slightly different than 4/3. And if the scaling of this is not exactly the same as the scaling of this, which is not exactly the same as the scaling of this, then this cancellation can give you very strange results. And I think that's basically the story. I'll back it up a little bit. Yeah, I said direct numerical simulation, but then you have to ask, you know, just yeah. I mean, is it conceivable to ever get to a good scaling regime for the pressure with any numerical simulation you might ever do? And that brings up all sorts of interesting questions, which I will. So, let me go a little further with this. I think they wrote it in K-space. Even this doesn't look very nice in K-space. In fact, in K-space, Heisenberg wrote this down while he was interned at Farm Hall or something. He played with turbulence and wrote this expression in K-space. It's a kind of messy integral form with lots of logarithms, and it's much harder to get a feeling for. But in our space, it's very simple to see that the inertial range of the pressure comes from the inertial range of the velocity, which is not obvious. Now, what we did in this paper was to just look a little bit more closely at applying the Hill-Wilczek formula to direct numerical simulation. We used Chi Chen's direct numerical simulations, of course. And we found that this was, in fact, extremely sensitive. Well, there's several things that come in when you apply this to direct numerical simulations. First of all, because you have only, it's low Reynolds number, and you have only a finite scaling range, even for these guys, But then you're putting them into an integral operation. So the yes, the inertial range of the pressure comes from the inertial range of the velocity, but not locally, not from exactly the same point in space. It has a contribution from smaller distances, which will be contaminated by the dissipation range, and it has a contribution from larger distances, which will be contaminated by the energy-containing range. So that even if you, and I have, even if you started from the Bachelor formula, you will not get as good a scaling of the pressure as you do of the velocity, because the pressure comes from, has contributions from smaller r and from larger r. I'm sorry. No, it's an identity. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. If I have an arbitrarily extended power law range, then these integrals can be done, and they give back powers, because if you have a certain power on the right hand side, you get the same power on the left hand side. But that. Yeah, and that's been checked. The directly calculated.
Except for the large volume.
Yeah, except the pressure calculated directly from the simulation and calculated from this formula do agree in a reasonably satisfactory way. Excuse me? Is that my conclusion?
Is it true that
yeah, does not scale. That certainly doesn't scale like r to the fourth thirds. And there are people who say and that the best fit they can make to the pressure is its spectrum is more like k to the minus 5/3 than k to the minus 7/3. But I think there's no reason to believe that it has a power spectrum at all, a power law spectrum at all of its Reynolds number range. In real space, I think this is the only. It does not. I mean, no, it does not. I mean, you can always fit a straight line on a log-log plot over a limited range, but I don't know if there's much meaning to the exponent. I think we say something about in this paper, but I've already forgotten it. I didn't take it very seriously. So we basically apply, and what you do when you this brings up a whole range of controversial points, and Itamar doesn't get here till next week. But it is observed at low Reynolds numbers in direct numerical simulation. It's also observed to some extent in experiments that the inertial range scaling of these three people is not exactly the same. I mean, there are intermittency corrections, but they seem to be somewhat different, bigger for the transverse structure function than for the longitudinal. And there was a long battle a couple of years ago between Shi and Srini and myself, who published two papers in this area on the analysis of the simulations, and Prakashya and Lvov and their people, who said that these are not the right scaling variables at all, that you should be looking at other scaling variables. And it isn't, I think, at all obvious how that goes. I mean, my feeling is we were both wrong, but I'm not sure. But the group theory, I'm not sure, was done right. I mean, I think they're doing it right. They're doing it right. I don't think they're doing group theory now correctly for the lower order, for the second order structure functions in an anisotropic flow, which is actually of some considerable interest, and Srini's involved in that too. But for the higher order structure ones functions, I don't think, do they still claim that they did the group theory right?
I think that at the moment it's somewhat up in the air. I mean, I wouldn't claim that they're wrong or they're right.
Okay. I mean, I think it's up in the air. I mean, but there is a controversy as to whether these are appropriate scaling variables at all. Just let's leave it at that. And whether the group theory gives a clean answer to that. For the fourth order, I don't know.
If you look at experimentally, the alternate variables, like the tail, the first and the nucleus, or type of arguments, and look at their scaling, it's not at all clear that they're scaling any better than this. So I can't
You mean the scaling variables that they proposed back then, yeah. What we can say is that observationally at low Reynolds numbers, these things do not have exactly the same effective scaling exponents. Whether there are, should be any genuine whether asymptotically they can scale differently is, I think, still open. But now it's sufficient to say that when you look at the actual numbers from direct numerical simulation, there are slight differences in the scaling of these things, observed effective scaling, and the cancellation in fact is not quite as complete as it is in the quasi-Gaussian approximation. It's kind of 90% instead of 95%, but the qualitative point is still there, and the pressure differences are extremely sensitive to small apparent differences in the scaling of these things. And whether those are apparent differences or are in fact real and will persist to very high Reynolds numbers, I think is still an open question.
So that is a good testimony to do, aside from saying that we do simulations.
Okay, that's why I think, because Luca will be here next week, but he can tell you about this sometime during the spring. I think it was a rather nice paper by Bifarale and collaborators called The Physics of Pressure and Pressure-Velocity Correlations in Isotropic Turbulence. And he did two things. I'm not going to try to discuss that in detail because he'll be here, but he did two things, both of which I think support let's take the point of view that I must say I am beginning to lean towards that asymptotically at extremely high Reynolds numbers, probably these three things do scale the same. And why? I don't know why. But I'm not sure. Let's save this for next week and maybe well after that. But even if they do at extremely high Reynolds numbers, certainly the finite Reynolds number effects will be extremely persistent. This is going to be extremely sensitive at any finite Reynolds number to small differences apparent differences in the scaling between among these. I think that's all I would want to say at the moment. Now, what Bifarale did was two things. First of all, it is known, and this was stated quite explicitly by Hill and Wilczak, that this expression is quite sensitive to the assumption of isotropic turbulence. A direct numerical simulation, since it's done in the cube, is not perfectly isotropic. Now, one of the things that Srini and Procaccia and also Luca Bifarale have been working on in recent times is to try to do the group theory so that you can project out in an anisotropic flow to project out onto the isotropic sector. And in fact, Luca was able to show in a direct numerical simulation of a channel flow that he was able to get much better scaling, even at very low Reynolds number, from the isotropic sector of the flow than from the full flow. So one thing you might worry about is whether small deviations from isotropy in the direct numerical simulation of supposedly homogeneous isotropic turbulence could make a big difference in this cancellation. And so he did for an isotropic simulation. He did the projection onto the truly isotropic isotropic simulation in a cube. He did the projection onto the spherically symmetric sector and found no change. So the worry that you might have that this thing is so sensitive to anisotropy that even the small anisotropy in a direct numerical simulation would be causing this problem, that worry he seems to have cleaned up. Nothing changed. But the other thing he asked, which I think is a much more interesting question, and I haven't thought about it much yet, he said, look, what you're saying qualitatively in all of this stuff is that pressures scale like the squares of velocities. That's your qualitative point. So he said, can I find a variable which involves the pressure, which has some more constraints on it, perhaps due to energy balance, and which might show better scaling than the pressure structure function itself? And the quantity he chose to look at are he chose to look at combinations of which essentially pressure times velocity. And he asked for various statistical properties of the product of, for example, P of X, V of X minus P of X plus R, V of X plus R. And he looked at statistical properties of various moments of this in isotropic homogeneous turbulence, and asked if these, which he could give a certain amount of physical motivation for, would show better scaling than the straight pressure structure functions. Maybe it's just that the pressure structure function is so constructed that it does. By the way, I don't know of any simple physical understanding of why the pressure is so small compared to why you get this cancellation, this large degree of cancellation. I never understood that physically. But he said, let's take something which has got a little more direct physical interpretation, see if it scales better. It does. So if he makes a pressure velocity combination and looks at the scaling of that, it's not bad. Say it's still for isotropic turbulence. Excuse me? Pressure at point X times velocity at point X minus the same quantity. No, just one component. Yeah. I think. No, he was you. It was the lunch. Well, I'm not sure it matters since the pressure is a scalar. But anyway, he's done this. We should let him talk about this more carefully. But it scales quite decently. So his argument is. But it scales. It scales like a velocity cubed, as you'd expect it to do. It velocity cubed is the beast which is responsible for the energy transfer, and so you'd expect this to scale like a velocity. Naively, you'd expect this to scale like a velocity cubed, which means that the structure function should go roughly as R, and it does.
I don't think I agree with that.
Well, why don't we wait till he's here, and we'll get into it later. But those are the two principal points. First of all, he looked for one is that if you make a pressure velocity combination which you expect to behave like, on naive grounds, to behave like a velocity difference cubed, it does. So, I mean, when analyzing the simulation.
I would agree with the word naive.
Hmm?
I would agree with the word.
Okay. Well, I think he has a. You can pick this thing. I mean, I think I haven't looked carefully at his energy argument, but he relates this quantity to energy balance. Excuse me? Well, it's roughly related. He argues that this quantity is in some rough way related to differences in the velocity to delta V cubed, which is related, as we know, to the energy transfer. He started from pressure gradient, but then he did some games with it. When he gets here, we should get this paper out and go over it more carefully. Yeah, that's where he started, but then he did some integrals by parts and played, and yeah. Yeah, no, that's, I agree, yeah, yeah. but.
And this is an interesting quantity in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
In the Fermat modeling business, especially.
Yeah. I think I, rather than trying to go into details of that, which first of all I haven't been through carefully, and second of all he's coming, let me just take a few minutes to mention the fourth point. This is really a somewhat independent point.
You didn't say much about the Watkins
containing
the reference
to. Oh. In this one?
Yes.
This is just applying the Hill-Wilczek formula to the direct numerical simulation. Yeah. Now, well, let me take a look at something else where there is also still some amusing, I don't know how much controversy there still is, but let me write, go back to the pressure in terms of the vorticity and strain. Yeah. Just a sec. Yeah.
But it appears that when we add a very large constant to pressure, then all the measurements is relative.
No, but we're talking about the pressure difference between two points.
Yeah.
We're talking about pressure differences and pressure gradients.
But when we take this pressure P times U minus P times U, the constant is the
But U minus U is zero because it's at two different points because it's homogeneous. Well, if you square it, okay.
Square it, then
yeah, okay, yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. I think it does.
So there's no mean value. Those two expressions that happen, you fold by zero, then are zero. The pressure velocity, the correlation is zero, and the separation is zero. They only show positive negative correlation in the part. So in this expression, V of R times V of R, this is the result, right?
So the expectation of P times U is going to be zero.
That's exactly right. For zero when R is zero.
I want to look at this. I want to get you get take a few minutes, which is now not related to computing pressure, but related to the actually to the scaling of these guys.
Is that the spectrum?
That's basically the spectrum with some. Now this expression has been used as, for example, to argue that there have been microbubble visualizations of turbulent flows, where you try to visualize the regions of high vorticity from the regions of low pressure. When you study that carefully in direct numerical simulation, which Chen has done, you find that. That works for extreme values, but it doesn't. There's no really very good correlation between low pressure, moderately low pressure regions and moderately high vorticity regions. But I want. Okay. But I want to take a look at this from a spectral point of view because it has some rather weird behavior. The mean square strain, we can write the strain is basically 1 over the kinematic viscosity times the local rate of energy dissipation. We can write the mean square, we can write the vorticity as, if you wish, I can just multiply and divide by viscosity. Nobody can stop me from doing that. And we think that in the limit of viscosity going to zero or Reynolds.
That's what happened on the tube.
Okay. We think that in the limit of viscosity going to zero, that the rate of energy dissipation is finite. on the average. We think that in the limit of viscosity going to zero, if we're taking an inertial range scale, that the pressure is finite. The pressure has a finite inertial range. But this expression then looks very strange. Because this says that if I go to an inertial range separation or equivalently to very large values of very small values of the viscosity, I get something like this. I'll call this thing D. So if you look at the quantities, the left hand side is finite as nu goes to zero. This guy is finite as nu goes to zero. And this guy, which is so nu times omega squared, is also finite as nu goes to zero. Which means if we start talking about cancellations, we're now talking about not just big cancellations, but overwhelming cancellations. We're talking about cancellations of the dominant singularity. The difference between dissipation and nu times mean square vorticity must cancel so strongly that you cancel out the dominant singularity in this thing and leave yourself only with a finite pressure on the left-hand side. Well, who cares? Well, the reason that this is of some interest is that there was another controversy floating around many years ago, and that is that the scaling of the dissipation and the spectrum of this is usually defined as going like k to the minus 1 plus the famous spectral exponent, the famous dissipation scaling exponent mu. And then you could also look at the scaling of the vorticity counterpart, which if you correspondingly would be scale with a spectral exponent mu sub omega. And the evidence from direct numerical simulation is in fact, all the evidence from direct numerical simulation over a 20-year period is that the vorticity is more intermittent than the strain. And experiment. So it suggests that mu omega is greater than mu. And there was a... We were involved in analyzing the simulations to show this. And then a group at Los Alamos of Shi-Yi Chen and some of his postdocs and Bob Craigman analyzed a system which I think you'll probably talk about next week, of an arbitrarily constructed assembly of static vortices, in which he was able to show that the asymptotic high Reynolds number scaling ratio of vorticity to strain was bounded, and that therefore in the infinite Reynolds number limit, these two exponents could not be different. Although when he did the very high finite Reynolds numbers for the same system, which he could do in to much higher Reynolds number than you could do real turbulence, there was an apparent difference. And when they told me that, and after I thought about it a little bit, it occurred to me that you really didn't need the model system, that you could tell directly from here. There's no way that you can get this degree of cancellation of the dominant singularity if these two guys don't have the same dominant scaling exponent. So in the true high Reynolds number limit, it's kind of three lines of algebra, which is what this paper is, which says that in the infinite Reynolds number limit, these scaling exponents, if they exist, have to be the same. If the pressure is finite, and if you don't even need that the dissipation be finite, you only have to be that it's weakly singular, because this is a factor of 1 over nu squared out there, which is so that if the pressure is no more than weakly vanishing, if this is no more than weakly vanishing, and this then this must these guys have to vanish in the same way if it's going to cancel out a dominant singularity of this kind. So it seems to me there's a very simple argument, not involved using only the finiteness of the pressure, which is something that came in a very early stage of this talk, that this cancellation has to be really a cancellation of a dominant singularity. And that's why you don't want to use this to calculate the pressure, obviously, but even at finite Reynolds number. But again, the evidence seems to be, and I think it's a good time to kind of stop, because there's a common message throughout all of this, which is that you have to be awfully careful about when you're in the high Reynolds number limit for scaling purposes. There are certain quantities, and the longitudinal component of the velocity seems to be the best example, and maybe the only example, in which the scaling seen at relatively low Reynolds number in direct numerical simulation and the scaling seen at high Reynolds number in experiment agree remarkably well. All of the scale, I mean, there's a story of all these anomalous exponents, whether you get them from the computer or you get them from the lab, they're very closely the same. But I'm not sure it's true for anything else. And it's not clear what's going on with the transverse. It's pretty clear that although vorticity seems more intermittent than strain at any finite Reynolds number you look at, that can't persist in the infinite Reynolds number limit for inertial range scaling. So you have to be very careful about which quantities approach, how various quantities approach their high Reynolds number scaling limits, and we know so far very little about this. Let me just leave it there. Say it again? Yeah. Well, yeah, if you think of Kolmogorov as a mean field theory, which, by the way, I've never seen any clean statement even of that. Intuitively we all say it, I've been saying it for 25 years, but I never could show it.
Going back to Rahul's question, on the omega square, the D that he has, there are two types of evidence. One is, of course, the numerical, which really measures everything in a coarser way, that is, actually obtains omega and that all this stuff. Experimentally, people measure only one component of the vorticity, and it favors diversion and all this. So keep this in mind when I make it. So in numerical simulations, maybe depending on how generous you are in your interpretation of scaling, about, say, one decade is about what you find, which is very inadequate. Experimentally, keeping all the inadequacies in mind, you at very high Reynolds numbers, like in the atmosphere, where you select your data and data and so on, you can get about maybe 2 decades.
But this is true for the vorticity also? Or?
Vorticity, yes. Yeah.
Because the vorticity is the hard thing to measure.
Right. One component is all that. People have measured all three components, but they haven't looked at the scaling. The ones that have looked at the scaling use only one component and use the Taylor psychology for our
scaling. I think there's a real danger in drawing too much interest in the DNS data right now for all the reasons you quoted. But I think the other problem is if you look at mobile square and your dissipation and your square vorticity and strain rate, they're all dominated by the highest rate and the pressure because of the number of cases. Of course, it's dominated by very low rate numbers at the time. And the simulations, in fact, the paper Hong Yu's been passing around shows really clearly that the high and the low wave numbers where the simulations are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be drawing kinds of emphasis from the data itself, which is not appropriate.
From DNS data, you mean? Because you're saying that these things could be very sensitive to
numerical inadequacies at the highest wave numbers that you're including. Well, the arguments here are not a higher order statistic, it's only the spectrum.
Dissipation, I mean, these things are clearly evident when you play a major role. Look at the low end, just E of K. The low end has big problems too. And this has to do with the fact you don't have any reason with the average.
Yeah, sure. No.
And it seems to take extraordinarily long time for these things to settle in. When we're dividing
Well, you're not, yeah.
I think
oh, wait a minute, I'm not. Well, I never suggested that you calculate pressure this way. Okay, maybe.
One of the things they plan to do during this first month or so is collect numerical simulation people here, all of them, so 4 or 5, and we are really need to do. And we will try to build them and find out what they think.
Yeah. Well, this was. The one of the things which was I mentioned, which of course, was that DNS in a cube is not perfectly isotopic. As far as I know, this test that Luca did here is the first test of that. But there are other. But they're much more. The forcing schemes vary very widely. I mean, to get a decent power law range, you play games with the way you externally drive the turbulence, and everybody has their own favorite forcing scheme, and I don't think anyone's looked very carefully at how sensitive things are to that.
In fact, the forcing scheme, C, Jupiter, for instance, has theory of things to scale, so it looks in the energy as a reason to go down the way it's supposed to go. Of course, maybe it doesn't have any impact on the argument.
But but we don't have any very careful, I mean, for example, the guy at Georgia Tech, he's not going to be here, though. Is he P.K. Young? Yeah, but P.K. does his forcing very differently than that. And sort of everybody does their own. And no, we haven't seen any qualitative differences, but nobody's really quantitatively.
I looked at a few quantitative things. For instance, you want to find out what the extent of scaling is.
Yeah. Okay. And with Xi's scheme giving a bigger range. Yeah, because it's designed to. Yeah. Yeah.
That is the last way.
Can I make a short comment?
Yeah,
I want to just comment on this thing here because it sort of emphasizes the point mark thing. I prefer to call it FP, P, which is PI going to efficient. But that thing you can show, just one over density square, is, and I can't remember the minus.
So density is one for all theorists.
I'm an expert analyst.
And the speed of sound is one.
It's
infinite.
Shown exactly the Fn, n, comma, n, n. Now, let me tell you what that is. These are all these fourth order invariants from isotropy. Like, for example, this thing separated by R or K space would be FL. L, comma, L, L. So you can see N, N would be two velocities this way and two velocities in Fourier space that way. Or you could put it in structure functions and get the same thing. They're analogous to what Mark drew here. But the interesting thing is with all the velocities, F, I, J, K, L, okay, are proportional to F, L, L, comma, L, L, or some other perturbation. What's interesting is this one is the weakest. In fact, you can even expand. Benetta and Antonia showed that you can expand all the one dimensions, the things you measure in terms of this, and you've got a minus 5/3, minus 7/3, so forth and so on. The interesting thing is this one is, and again, not worrying about the scaling exponent, but it's k minus 7/3, where this one and all the others k minus 5/3. So you can sort of see from this what's happening is this dependence on these two components. Somehow the correlation between these two components is a lot weaker than the correlation between those two components. So if there's a physical explanation, I'll bet it lies in that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that he does thought funny things for the normal correlations. It always makes the one go zero.
Yeah, I know about this result in your paper, and I've never been able to put it together, to connect it to the Hill-Wilczek thing. There is got to be a connection.
My guess is, what's interesting in this spectral space is this is the one term, whereas the Hill formulation is a whole bunch of terms that cancel out.
Mm-hmm.
So that must be the canceled out piece. That's what's left.
Is that the exact statement?
That's the exact statement. Mm-hmm. Carl, in my paper, what we had to do is I had to use the fourth order Gaussian to proceed beyond this.
Yeah, there's a lot of this kinematics which is all in Monin and Yaglom, which I've never really, but connecting these guys back to the connecting this NN back to the structure functions, I presume if you for isotropic turbulence, you would end up with the Hill-Wilczek result. It may even be in the Hill-Wilczek paper, actually, because they did to some extent, and they have and Reg Hill's published several thick reports which didn't fit into the paper also.
So. We have to work out all these velocities.
Yeah, well he.
You
say Reg Hill will be here because he's very good at this stuff. I mean, he really can calculate like crazy.
But let me ask you, there are some smart or clever questions that you can ask to advance our, let's say, lesson or uncertainty.
Well, I think Luca Bifarelli did something very close to that by looking at the right pressure velocity correlation.
Okay.
But we should wait till he's here and
And
we get him to talk about this.
Thank you.
response, or do we...
No, I think you buy the speaker. You buy the speaker a beer, I think, is the certainly.
Okay, all right. Good.